Now they moved along the wagon trail with renewed determination. Even Kia was infected with this enhanced sense of purpose. Twice they cut the trail of herds of elephant coming down out of the Northlands. Perhaps in some mysterious way the elephant were aware of the bounty the rains had brought upon the land. From afar, Kurt surveyed the massed herds of these grey giants through the lens of his telescope, but he showed only a passing interest in them. He would not let a hunt for a few ivory tusks deter him from his main quest. He ordered Thea to detour round the herds, and they went onwards, leaving them unmolested. Both Kurtz and Kadem grudged every hour of delay, and they drove horses and men hard along the tracks of their quarry. They passed out of the wide swathe that the locusts had cut through the land, and left the great plains behind them. They entered a lovely land of rivers and lush forests, and the air tasted as sweet as the perfume of wild flowers. Scenes of great beauty and grandeur surrounded them, and the promise of riches and glory led them onwards. "We are not far behind the wagons now," Thea promised them, "and each day we draw closer." Then they came to a confluence of two rivers, a wide, deep flow and a smaller tributary. Thea was amazed by what he found there. He led Kurtz and Kadem through the field of rotting, sun-dried human remains, which had been chewed and scattered by the hyena and other scavengers. He did not have to point out to them discarded spears and assegais and the rawhide shields, most of them shot through by musket fire.
"There was a great battle here," Thea told them. "These shields and weapons are those of the fierce Nguni tribes."
Kurtz nodded. No man who had lived and travelled in Africa as he had could have been ignorant of the legend of the warrior tribes of the Nguni.
"Good so," he said. "Tell us what else you see here." "The Nguni attacked the wagons Samoya had drawn up here across the neck between the two rivers. That was a good place for him, his back and both his sides protected by the water. The Nguni had to come at him from the front." "Heh! He killed them like chickens."
Thea giggled and shook his head with admiration. Kurtz walked across to the crater in the middle of the area of devastated ground in front of which the wagons had stood.
"What is this?" he asked. "What happened here?"
Thea picked a short length of charred slow match out of the dirt and brandished it. Even though he had seen fuse and explosives used before, he did not have the vocabulary to describe it. Instead, he mimed the act of lighting the slow match and made a sizzling sound as he ran along the path the flame must have taken. When he reached the crater, he shouted, "Ba-poof!" and leapt high into the air to illustrate the explosion. Then he fell on his back and kicked both legs, shrieking with laughter. It was so expressive that even Kurtz had to laugh.
"By the pox-ridden vagina of the great whore," he guffawed, "the Courtney puppy let off a mine under the impis as they stormed the wagons. Oh, we will have to take care when we catch up with him. He has grown as crafty as his father."
It took Thea the rest of the day to unravel all the secrets of the battlefield, spread out as it was over such a vast stretch of the veldt. He showed Kurtz the path the routed impis had taken, and how Jim Courtney and his men had chased them on horseback and shot them down as they ran. They came at last to the abandoned Nguni encampment, and Thea became almost incoherent as he realized the extent of the cattle herds Jim had captured.
"Like the grass! Like the locusts!" he squeaked, as he pointed out the spoor the herds had trodden as they were driven away eastwards.
1,000? Kurtz wondered. 5,000, or maybe more?
He tried to form a rough estimate of the value of these cattle if he could get them to Good Hope. "There are not enough guilders in the Bank of Batavia," he concluded. "One thing is certain. When I catch up with him, Odoman and these stinking Hottentots will not see a single centime. I will kill them first before I hand over a guilder. By the time I am finished here, I will make Governor van de Witten look like a pauper in comparison." That was not the end of it. When they entered the camp, Thea led him to the far side of the encampment where a stockade stood, made of stout timber poles lashed together with strips of bark. Kurtz had never seen such a sturdy construction, even in the permanent villages of the tribes. "Is it a grain store?" he wondered, as he dismounted and entered.
He was further puzzled when he found that it contained what seemed to be drying or smoking racks. However, there was no sign of ash or scorched areas beneath them. As with the construction of the walls, the timber used seemed too massive for such a simple purpose. It was clear that the racks had been designed to support a much greater weight than strips of meat. Clear was trying to tell him something. He jumped up on the racks and repeated the word chicken. Kurtz frowned irritably. This was no hen coop, nor even an ostrich coop. Kurtz shook his head. Clear began another mime, holding one arm in front of his face like a long nose and flapping his other hand from the side of his head like an ear. Kurtz puzzled over the meaning, then remembered that the San words for chicken and elephant were almost identical. "Elephant?" he asked, and touched the elephant hide belt at his waist. "Yes, yes, you stupid man," Clear nodded vigorously. "Are you mad?" Kurtz asked in Dutch. "An elephant would never fit through the doorway." Clear leapt down from the rack and ferreted around under it. Then he crawled out again. He showed Kurtz what he had found. It was an immature tusk taken from an elephant calf. It was only as long as Clear's forearm, and so slim that he could encircle it at the thickest point with thumb and finger. It must have been overlooked when the storeroom was emptied. Clear waved it in Kurtz's face. "Ivory," Kurtz began to understand. 5 years previously, when he was acting as aide-de-camp to the governor of Batavia, the governor had made an official visit to the Sultan of Zanzibar. The Sultan was proud of his collection of ivory tusks. He had invited the governor and his staff to tour his treasury and view the contents. The ivory had been laid out on racks, much like these, to keep it off the damp floor.
"Ivory," Kurtz breathed hard. "These are ivory racks."
He imagined the tusks stacked high, and tried to estimate the value of such a treasure.
"In the name of the Black Angel, this is another great fortune to match the plundered herds of cattle."
He turned and strode out of the shed.
"Sergeant," he bellowed. "Sergeant Alderman, get the men mounted up. Kick the brown backsides off our Arab friends. We ride at once. We must catch Jim Courtney before he reaches the coast and comes under the protection of the guns of his father's ships."
They rode eastwards along the spoor of the cattle herds, a beaten roadway almost a mile wide, along which the cattle had grazed and trodden down the grass.
"A blind man could follow this on a moonless night," Kurtz told Cadam, who rode beside him. "What a fine bait this piglet of the great hog will make for our trap," Cadam agreed with grim determination.
They expected to come up with the wagons and the herds of plundered cattle at any moment. However, day succeeded day, and although they rode hard and Kurtz took every opportunity to spy out the land ahead through his telescope, they caught no glimpse of either cattle or wagons. Each day Clear assured them that they were gaining rapidly. From the sign he was able to tell Kurtz that Jim Courtney was hunting for elephant while his caravan was on the march.
"This is slowing him down?" Kurtz asked. "No, no, he hunts far ahead of the wagons. Then we can surprise the caravan while he's not with them, to defend him."
"We have to catch up with them first," said Cadam, and Clear cautioned Kurtz that if they approached Jim Courtney's caravan too closely, before they were ready to attack it, Buckhut would immediately discover their presence.
"In just the same way as I discovered that these brown baboons," he indicated Cadam and his Arabs disdainfully, "were creeping up on us, although Buckhut is no match for Clear, the mighty hunter, in stealth and wizardcraft, neither is he a fool. I have seen his footprints and his sign, where he swept his back trail every evening before the wagons went into camp."
"How do you know it is Buckhut's sign?" Kurtz demanded.
Buckhut is my enemy, and I can pick out his footprints from those of any other man that walks this land."
Then Clear pointed out other circumstances that Kurtz had not taken into consideration before. The signs showed clearly that Jim Courtney had made other additions to his retinue, apart from the herds of captured cattle. Men. Many men. Clear thought there were at least 50. And that there might be as many as 100 additional men to face them when they attacked the wagons. Clear had employed all his genius and wizardry to determine the character and condition of these new men. Hey, they are big, proud men. That I can tell by the manner in which they carry themselves, by the size of their feet and the length of their stride, he told Coots. They bear arms and are free men, not captives or slaves. They follow Somoya willingly, and they guard and care for his herds. It comes to me that these are Nguni, who will fight like warriors.
Coots was learning from experience that it was best to accept the little bushman's opinion. So far, he had never been wrong in such matters. With such quantity and quality of reinforcements added to the hard core of mounted musketeers, Jim Courtney had now mustered a formidable force which Coots dared not underestimate.
"We are outnumbered many times over. It will be a hard fight," Coots weighed these new odds.
"Surprise," said Cadham. "We have the element of surprise. We can choose our time and place to attack."
"Yes," Coots agreed. By this time his opinion of the Arab as a warrior had been much enhanced. "We must not waste that advantage."
11 days later they came to the brink of a deep escarpment. There were tall snow-capped mountain peaks to the south, but ahead the land dropped away steeply in a confusion of hills, valleys and forest. Coots dismounted and steadied his spyglass on Clea's shoulder. Then suddenly he shouted aloud as he picked out in the blue distance the even bluer tint of the ocean.
"Yes," he cried, "I was right all along. Jim Courtney is headed for Nativity Bay to join up with his father's ships. That is the coast less than 100 leagues ahead."
Before he could fully articulate his satisfaction at having pursued the quest so far, something even more compelling caught Coots's eye. In the wide expanse of land and forest below him, he descried drifts of pale dust dispersed over a wide area, and when he turned the glass on these clouds, he saw beneath them the movement of the massed herds of cattle, slow and dark as spilled oil, spreading on the carpet of the veldt.
"Mother of Satan!" he cried. "There they are! I have them at last!"
With a mighty effort he checked his warlike instinct to ride down on them immediately. Instead, he cautioned himself to consider all the circumstances and eventualities that he and Cadem had discussed so earnestly over the past days.
"They are moving slowly, at the speed of the grazing herds. We can afford the time to rest our own men and horses and prepare ourselves for the attack. In the meantime, I will send Clea ahead to scout Jim Courtney's dispositions, to learn his line of march, the character of his new men, and the order of battle of his horsemen."
Cadem nodded agreement as he surveyed the ground below them.
"We might circle out ahead and lie in ambush, perhaps in a narrow pass through the hills or at a river crossing. Order Clear to have an eye for a place such as that."
"Whatever happens, we must not let them join up with the ships that might already be waiting for them in Nativity Bay," said Coots. "We must attack before that happens, or we will be facing cannon and grapeshot as well as muskets and spears."
Coots lowered the telescope and grabbed Clear by the scruff of his neck to impress upon him the seriousness of his orders. Clear listened earnestly and understood at least every second word that Coots growled at him.
"I will find you here when I return," Clear agreed, when Coots ended his harangue.
Then he trotted away down the escarpment wall without looking back. He did not have to make any further preparations for the task ahead of him, for Clear carried upon his sturdy back every possession he owned. It was a little before noon when he set out, and late afternoon before he was close enough to the cattle herds to hear their distant lowing. He was careful to cover his own sign and not to approach any closer. Despite his braggadocio, he held Bakat's powers in high respect. He circled round the herds to find the exact position of Samoya's wagons. The cattle had trodden the tracks and confused the sign, so it was difficult even for him to read as much from them as he wanted. He came up level with the wagons, but a league out to the north of their line of march, when suddenly he stopped. His heart began to pound like the hoofbeats of a galloping herd of zebra. He stared down at the dainty little footprint in the dust.
"Hey, Bakat," he whispered. "My enemy. I would know your sign anywhere, for it is imprinted on my heart."
All Kurtz's orders and exhortations were wiped from his mind, and he concentrated all his powers on the spoor.
He goes quickly and with purpose. In a straight line, not pausing or hesitating, he shows no caution. If ever I can surprise him, this is the day.
Without another thought, he turned aside from his original purpose and followed the tracks of Buckhut, whom he hated above all else in his world.